We are talking today with Katrina Vandenhoevel. Katrina Vandenhoevel is editor and publisher of The Nation magazine and writes the Editor's Cut blog there. She is a frequent commentator on American and international politics for ABC, MSNBC, CNN, and PBS. Her articles have appeared in numerous publications, including the Boston Globe, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, Foreign Policy Magazine, and the Washington Post, where she also writes a weekly web column. She is the author of The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama, Meltdown, How Greed and Corruption Shattered Our Financial System and How We Can Recover, and co-editor of Taking Back America and Taking Down the Radical Right. Katrina, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us today.
Thank you, Mike.
So, start out, you are in town as part of a year-long celebration of The Nation magazine. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. The Nation was founded in 1865 in New York City by a group of abolitionists committed to ending slavery. And since those years, The Nation has become a national publication. And in that spirit, we wanted to take The Nation on tour across this country, not just celebrate in New York City. So we've been from Tucson, Salt Lake City, Boston, Madison, Seattle. We were in Portland. We're going to do San Francisco. And we want to come into cities and partner with progressives, with movements, with communities, and talk about the state of media, talk about the state of our movements, of our politics, what's possible, what is arrayed against us. And so it's a great treat to be with you. Seattle, you know, is in 1999, and I've been editor for 20 years, so there's a kind of alignment in this anniversary. But I remember my colleague, John Nichols, who's our national affairs correspondent, a great ally, colleague, telling me, you know, we really have to give great coverage to the WTO protests in Seattle. This is the beginning of a fair globalization movement that is going to change the world we live in. We did a special issue, John, and we had a whole team of people here covering, reporting. One of our columnists, Naomi Klein, of course, made her great name in some ways with her book No Logo, which came around that time and reflected the swirling ideas and protests and change. But I think you can trace the arc. There's a continuum from what happened in Seattle to what we see today as we sit here. Thousands of people in the streets around this country and around the world challenging austerity politics and a discredited status quo politics that has failed people, And I've always resisted, you know, anti-globalization, because I think we as a progressive left, it's important that we both protest, but we also propose. And I've tried to do that at The Nation. My column in the 150th anniversary issue, which came out in April, I hope your listeners will go to thenation.com. You can download that issue. My column in that issue is called There Are Always Alternatives. And I believe that. You know, there's the rallying cry, you know, there is another world. And then there was the kind of anti-rallying cry, there is no alternative. I believe British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, architect of severe austerity programs, like that line. I believe there are always alternatives in politics, life, love, society, culture, and part of The Nation's reason for existence is to make sure that the corporate media doesn't police the parameters of what's possible, that we challenge continually over time the conventional orthodoxy. We challenge what the mainstream media presents as what is viable. And in so doing, I think we lift up ideas that may be too early for their time, not ready for prime time or heretical, but they come around. One example, two examples. One is, you know, we were unwaveringly opposed to the Iraq War. And it's, you know, your listeners may not remember how brutally coercive the conformity was at that time. You know, it was like, and to criticize government in wartime is not a path to popularity. But we opposed for many reasons. And today, though you do have those rogue elements like Bill Kristol and neocons and some other neolibs, for the most part, I think people understand what a debacle it was, how it's created some of the conditions, the chaos in the region, the misadventure that wasted trillions of dollars that so many lives, Iraqis, Americans, were lost, so damaged this country in fundamental ways. In any case, that's part of the nation's DNA, and I'll stop. But, you know, we opposed one of the strands, the through lines of the nation's history, is a belief that empire is toxic for democracy. And one of our great former contributing editors, the late Gore Vidal, really, you know, wrote 25 essays for The Nation. I'd say at least two-thirds of those were about empire. And I think it's something to think about. We don't often think of ourselves as an empire. Some do. But I think there's a danger for the nature of the republic in our democracy. When one is an empire, it corrodes values that we believe are important. But too many say they're important, like too many go to church, but then they're not truly churchly. In any case, we're very happy to be in Seattle because I think so much, going back to WTO, so much has come out of this city. And I know that there are real problems. New York City has real problems. But we also are seeing a progressive movement, a moment. The Fight for 15 is, I think, really now fused with the history of this city for good reason. It really erupted here. And that energy has flowed through the country in ways that are very hopeful.
I remember The Nation being a key source that I turned to and discovered when I first became an activist. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing enough, if, especially in this day and age when media folding, longtime media folding all around us, that that you can make it to 100 years, let alone 150 years.
Yeah, no, I agree. You make it to 5 years. I mean, it's like, they do surveys of marriage. But more seriously, we are living, and to say that we're living in a fast-shifting, volatile media landscape isn't really to capture what's going on. I mean, it is crazy shifting. I think we have survived because we are ferociously independent. We've remained true to our mission. We believe more we making a difference than a profit. We have a circle of people who give a certain amount each year, but we also have a network of about 20,000 small donors who give beyond the subscription price. And I welcome any of your listeners, thenation.com, check it out. But it is a testament to a belief that it's less about policies and political parties, but in what can happen when you tell people the truth and continue in doing that. Now, we have made some serious changes. We are still a weekly. Print remains our anchor in fundamental ways. But this July, we invested in a relaunch of a new website. It's nimble. It's beautiful. We believe we can tell stories in new ways. There's multimedia. I'm a firm believer in the fact we have 120,000 readers of the print each week, but we have more than 500,000 people reading us each week on different, quote, platforms. I'm not in love with all the talk about content and platforms and paywalls. I'd rather talk about, theories of change and, But it's a serious to get our journalism, and our ideas, to a new generation and to spread them more widely. I love it when someone writes from, Nashville or a town in Brazil. They can access us in ways that were not possible 15 years ago. So we're doing that. We're making sure we're present in the digital space and that we're traveling around the country. I mean, this 150th year is a big event because we're really moving. It's like a tour, concert tour, media tour. But every month in non-anniversary years, we're doing events, we're doing discussions. And I think those are important too because I believe what we do in The Nation or thenation.com is connect doers, thinkers, writers, activists. But you also want to see people face to face. You want to be like a living magazine, a living media outlet. So that's exciting. And I think, I feel we're taking what is a, it's part of the history now, The Nation, but we're moving it into this period. We're not sitting back on our laurels. I could sit here, I could say that James Baldwin in 1966 wrote an extraordinary piece called Occupied Territory Harlem, in which he decried the abuses of policing in Harlem. He spoke of the stop and frisk abuses. You can almost feel the arc, the continuum from his writing to the Black Lives Matter moment, movement. And we do take strength from those historical resources, but we also very much want to live in the moment. I do think, however, that if you don't bring history to bear, you become what Gore Vidal used to say, United States of Amnesia. And I think readers want some context and history, and I think younger readers want that. We have a really interesting piece running next week by our national affairs correspondent, William Grider, who used to be at Rolling Stone, about the GOP crack-up. And it's not like who's going to be the next speaker. It's not the horse race. It's looking back at the unholy marriage, essentially kind of officiated by Nixon's Southern strategy, and this unholy alliance between sort of country club Republicans and the base that is no longer working because the base, what everyone thinks of the base, is saying, we're getting shafted. We thought we were in this for something else, and these guys just want to lower taxes for themselves, you know, increase their corporate gains. What's going on here? So you look at the history, the context to bring to bear on this moment. And another side of the political. We've been covering Bernie Sanders for close on to 30 years. What has been so striking to me in watching this campaign unfold, many things, but just on the media landscape front, how many millions of people are meeting Bernie Sanders for the first time. Why is that? A large part of that seems to me that a corporate media has tried to, again, police the parameters of what's possible, what's viable, what's a viable political idea. And in so doing, that media has excluded people like Bernie Sanders because they're speaking of ideas that don't quite fit what the gatekeepers think works. But people, I think, are looking beyond the labels. I think there's a whole rethinking of what democratic socialism means. You got a younger generation, by the way, which has grown up with not too much of a rosy idea of the American dream. And they're saying, hey, this ain't bad. If this is democratic socialism, free higher ed, expanded Social Security, you know, higher taxes on the rich, let's get polluted money out of our political system. You know, maybe this isn't so bad, but I think it's a measure of Bernie Sanders was on Meet the Press, the Sunday morning show, which I think defines what is possible for the Beltway, the first time last year. And, you know, John McCain is on every other week. He's the most frequent Meet the Press guest in history. And I think right there you can see why what I call we have a downsized politics of excluded alternatives. But people are saying with their feet, with, you know, going to rallies, with we want to hear more. We want to hear more. We don't accept what we're being told is the only way to move forward. And I think movements have played an enormous role in that, Mike, because I think this is a movement moment. And we've seen them through time. Obviously, America has seen different movements. They're cyclical. But, you know, Black Lives Matter, economic justice, the fight for 15 fast food workers, climate justice movement. There was the People's Climate March here around the country yesterday. Naomi Klein, who's with us, going to be with us at Town Hall for our event, was part of that march. And I think, you know, Dreamers, you're seeing people aching for a change, unhappy with what's been given, wanting more, tired of being treated in unjust ways, tired of abuse. And that pushes things in very exciting ways.
Watching the first presidential Democratic debate this week, and Anderson Cooper asking the panel after he had address Bernie Sanders, is there anyone else up here that's not a capitalist?
So I found it quite extraordinary. It was almost a, you know, vertiginous moment of vertigo to say it's not red baiting. It wasn't red baiting. It was, you know, a discussion for a moment and within the confines of a CNN debate, but of democratic socialism and capitalism. There's much more to be said. But it's a teachable moment. I mean, what I find heartening is a year ago the nation called for competitive contested primaries, for not allowing our elections to be hijacked by big money, by pundits, by strategists who are going to tell us how to think. And I think we're witnessing some of that play out, not fully because we still have an election system which is corroded in some deep ways. But you're having there was a substantive, serious debate Tuesday night. And to have that question asked the question of who's a democratic socialist, let's hear more about it. There's much more to be said. The thing I regret is that, there are many forms of capitalism, too. There's crony capitalism. There's casino capitalism. There's inclusive capitalism. But let's have that discussion. This country deserves to know more about a system, democratic socialism, that has been tarred, feathered with red brushes. My view of Bernie Sanders, yes, he's a democratic socialist, but he continues to refer to Denmark when asked about it. I see him essentially as an unreconstructed New Dealer, modernizing the New Deal, with the exception of climate, which wasn't on the agenda back then. But what he's talking about is that you can retrieve in American history radical ideas or quasi-socialist ideas. What's Social Security? What's Medicare? What were public utilities? Still have them. There is a state bank in North Dakota. I mean, retrieve in our history. I'm not saying don't go abroad, but it's kind of like you could retrieve in our own history that tradition. And you know probably better than I do that around this country, Milwaukee, for example, there have been what are called sewer socialists. You now have in this great city, Shama Sawant, right? The first socialist, really, all city council. I know that's being changed, I think. But, these are people, it's not out of the American tradition. So I'm just saying, I think Anderson Cooper, people who say democratic socialism, they want it to be foreign. I think personally we can learn a lot from other countries. We're not doing so well. We're the only Western industrialized country with pretty lousy safety net, though that's being torn apart there too a little. But I just think it's important to retrieve in our own history these ideas, and they exist. And, sewer socialists who ran cities, ran municipal councils, and, all. So I just think it's an interesting moment.
And similar to Seattle, where we have elected so far, we're about to have another election here soon, but
it's in about four months. No,
it's just in November.
November. Oh, of course. I'm sorry. Yeah. So it's next month.
Yeah, which is weeks away. Finding out if we have a new landscape in the city. So is that? I know there are other cities where Greens, socialists are making a little headway.
A little headway. I think Seattle is. Shama has become, and we were very happy she wrote for our 150th anniversary issue on, why it's important to have socialists in power. But I don't know if I see socialists. I don't know if I see Greens making enough advances in cities around this country. I do think it's still, and Bernie Sanders wrestled with this. Was he going to run as an independent? He is an independent in the Senate or inside the Democratic Party. I think he made the right decision because I think he would have spent half the time he gets in the media. And by the way, it hasn't been a great amount of time. This past summer when he was bringing thousands of people to rallies in stadiums across this country, you would barely have known that because it was the summer of Trump for all kinds of reasons. Our media likes to make politics a spectator sport, a blood sport, a horse race, a football game. And I think in doing so does a great disservice to people. So in my view, it was the summer of Bernie Sanders as much as it was the summer of Donald Trump. But I think he's redefining, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. Howard Dean used to be credited with that line. But it's really the great late Senator Paul Wellstone who coined that term, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. Or you can think of Michael Harrington, who was head of Democratic Socialists of America, economist, strategist, wrote The Other America about poverty, which moved President Kennedy and later Lyndon Johnson to really lay out the war on poverty. He always liked to talk about the left wing of the possible. And I think with Bernie Sanders, we're seeing some of that. And not just Bernie Sanders. In my city, Mayor de Blasio ran on a platform of A Tale of Two Cities. He believes inequality is the existential crisis of our time. He has, with a coalition of scores of people, developed a progressive agenda, 14-point platform, to tackle inequality, to drive it into this election. That progressive agenda is going to hold forum in Iowa December 6th and invite all the candidates. Well, five Republicans, five Democrats, invite all the candidates, Republican, Democrats, to discuss in a forum their plans, their ideas for how to begin to end inequality. A huge, huge, important task. I haven't mentioned someone who I think also has played a vital role nationally in shifting this landscape we're living in. That is Senator Elizabeth Warren. I think her crystal clear voice on how the system is rigged, rigged against working people, working families, in favor of the very rich, the importance of rewriting the rules so that, you know, no one's ordinary, but ordinary people get a fair shot, created the space, created the moment into which a Bernie Sanders walked. And he has certainly created his own dynamic, but that space was going to be filled because this is a moment where people, as I said, are aching for something different, for something that speaks to them in a plain-spoken, straight-talking, real way. And, you know, there's a battle against the establishment. I'm for that. I'm a little bit against knocking out anyone who's been in government. I think the problem, and I see this among some of my great colleagues, they're, you know, Franklin Roosevelt once said, government is us, right? At the moment, it doesn't seem like us because it's been captured. There's, you know, what, 10 lobbyists for every representative, big money. But I don't think you throw out government. I think you take it back, you clean it up, you wipe it down, and you make sure it works for people and improves the conditions of people's lives and doesn't just line the pockets of our oligarchy.
So how does the nation, how do you see the debate amongst those who are, let's say, on the left to wrestle with these issues? For instance, taking Bernie Sanders, for example, you know, there a lot of people are like feeling like he's, you know, sheepdogging people for the Democratic Party, and that supporting his campaign is basically selling out to the really big goal. And I mean, like, my Facebook feed, boy, is just
full
a daily battle of
criticism of Sanders for being...
And that reflects on just about every other issue, too. You know, the purity versus
incremental absolutely. So I'm a believer you got to walk on two legs. You got to live in the world as it is while you try to build the world as it might be. I think if you cede the territory of electoral politics, you're going to cede the ground to the worst forces in our country. I think it has to be a movement-based politics that is intersecting with inside allies. There are debates. There are debates. There are debates at the nation. We're going to have them in our pages. One of the reasons I think we have thrived is that we are a venue for the debates between liberals and radicals and progressives and anarchists and a slew, a passel of forces on the left. And there are those who believe only movements make change. There are those who believe movements working with allies inside can lead to change, as we've seen through history. We have a lot of work to do. The Democratic Party is, for the most part, pretty corrupt. But there are also people inside it who write for the nation. There's a progressive caucus, two co-chairs, Raul Grijalva, Keith Ellison. They've endorsed Bernie Sanders, but more than that, they've championed a right to vote amendment. They've championed a Robin Hood tax, the financial transaction tax, which I like, which, you know, you tax Wall Street to rebuild Main Street. Now, this is not revolution. Bernie Sanders, by the way, talks about a political revolution. I'd like to always put in parens before revolution, peaceful. I think the history of revolution can be a great one, but it can also be a bloody one through time, history, and other countries' experience. But we do need to upend and uproot so many of the structures of power, the structures of oppression. But, you know, there's a beginning, and then there's a middle, and then there's an end point. And I think we got to find ways on the road. I think about that, my colleague John Nichols, we talk a lot about Citizens United. It's not the original sin, by the way, but it is a major sin, the Supreme Court unleashing unlimited corporate money into our already polluted political system. And John, you know, wants to go directly to a repealed Citizens United. And there, I think there's 16 states, 500 cities, which have moved on that. But I said to John, you know, that is a long, could be a lonely, could be, I mean, long battle. Can you give people points along the road so they can mobilize and fight and have something to organize around on that long road? Public financing. I mean, you know, eyes glaze over, but it's important because it will allow a waitress in Maine. I know someone who ran and who joined the state Senate and is doing good things because she knows what it's like to work below minimum wage, to get different kinds of people, and also build a movement. I see in my own city where we do have a public financing 6-to-1 match that I think, the 4 women of color joined the city council, the speaker of the city council now, Latino. These women wouldn't have been able to run or win. Letitia James is public advocate. So I think you open up the system to as many voices. But purity, you know, I've worked and the nation is still a place for, let me cite someone who I've gotten to know and who's going to write for us. From 1961 to 1966, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was our civil rights correspondent. He wrote an annual essay on the state of the civil rights movement. His last essay, called The Last Steep Ascent, which our contributor Walter Mosley read when we were in Portland for our event, was really about the fight for economic justice. He was moving into that terrain. And he came out against Vietnam 2 months before the famous Riverside Church at a Nation event in Los Angeles. I've come to know Reverend William Barber. Reverend William Barber, if your listeners don't know, leads the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina. It was triggered by the brutal cuts to Medicare, by the brutal suppression of voting rights, by the right-wing takeover of that state. Reverend Barber is a prophetic religious voice, but he is also someone who believes a moral imagination must define the movements of our time. And he's bringing together a kind of pro-democracy, multiracial fusion moment and movement. But he is someone, I think, who is pure in a different way. I mean, he's pure in the sense that he believes that there is a morality that cannot be bought, and he believes you lay out the vision. You don't get entangled in the compromises. You lay it out, you fight for it, you march for it, you bring people to it. And I think that is one of the movements of our time which is changing the narrative and changing the way people think. Purity gets you so far. Let me just go back to, I'll end with the Pope, if I could. The Pope coming to this country and speaking about Dorothy Day in Congress was one of the most extraordinary moments. And people, you know, people learned about Dorothy Day. There were people looking up, who's Dorothy Day? I think she once said something that despair is a sin, you know? And I think despair leads people, and you can't blame people, to a purity where they don't want to get their hands dirty, they don't want to mix it up, mess it up. But I'd love to hear someone like Ashama Sawant talk about purity. I think she has the courage of her convictions, she stays strong, she stakes it out. But she also, some might say the very pure, is getting her hands dirty because she's in city electoral politics.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us today.
Thank you.
Again, we've just been talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel. She is editor and publisher at The Nation magazine, and you can find out more via their website.
TheNation.com.